We all quest for happiness. But how do we measure a happy life? Is it linked to wealth, relationships, health, absence of physical or mental pain, or just doing good? Orthodox measures, like gross national product, don't get near it. It was the great American politician, Robert F. Kennedy, brother of President Bobby Kennedy, who once remarked that GNP measures everything except that which makes life worthwhile. And according to our guest today, he was onto something. Professor Lord Richard Layard has a long and distinguished career as one of our foremost economists, translating the insights of economics into practical measures to improve our well-being. He began working on unemployment, whose impact on people's self-worth is as devastating as the loss of income. But over the last few decades, that interest has transmuted into a more general focus on Robert Kennedy's preoccupation, well-being, an intangible good more valuable than tangible oil or rubies. But well-being isn't just organic food and yoga retreats. Well-being has grown into a science, using the wide empirical evidence now available that can help answer what contributes to a happy society and a happy life. Social science has come to the rescue. Professor Lord Richard Layard is founder of LSE's Centre of Economic Performance and co-directs its Community and Wellbeing Programme. Welcome to the WE Society from the Academy of Social Sciences. It's a pleasure. Yeah, an honour almost. No, an honour. Come on. It's a pleasure and honour to have you with us.
My honour. Your pleasure.
Now, when we invited you to join the WE Society podcast, what was your first thought when you heard this WE Society? What came into your head? What sense did you make of it?
Well, I two thoughts, actually. First, I very much like the idea that we matter more than I do. But I also noticed that W and E are the first two letters in well-being. So, yes, I'm definitely for the WE Society.
Now, before we kind of turn to your kind of preoccupation that's really been dominating your work over the last 20, 25 years, well-being and its relationship to happiness, let's just see how you got there. I mean, as an economist, your real focus in the 1980s and 90s was the labour market and unemployment. And then you went on to one of the people who worked on Labour Party's New Deal when they came into office in 1997. Just kind of give us a sense of what drove you into that kind of part of economics and what your major findings were.
Well, I actually became an economist in my 30s because I discovered that it was the only framework of thinking about what would be the best way of arranging public policies and society, looking at benefits, looking at costs. And then I thought, well, what are the most important aspects of the economy? And it really is people's ability to get jobs, which give them meaning in life, and to get income, which gives them the means of life. And so I studied, in particular, the sources of wage inequality and the sources of unemployment. And I came to the view with some wonderful colleagues that I worked with that unemployment varied enormously between countries, and it was very much affected by the way in which people were treated when they're unemployed. Did they get help out of unemployment, or were they alternatively, as in some countries still, given benefits without help and without conditions? And I came to the view that you must have active labour market policies.
And these are some of the great names in kind of world economics that you're working with. I mean, this was kind of Larry Summers, this was Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winners. I mean, these were your kind of colleagues with whom you're working on these dilemmas, right?
Yeah, they supported us. They gave us a lot of help. And we did eventually, after about 10 years of argument, get a government in Britain that implemented many of these ideas under Tony Blair's prime ministership.
So the important thing was marrying the search for work with getting unemployment benefit. So you got unemployment benefit. If you also accepted, you'd be helped back into employment one way or another. That was your big...
Exactly.
Yeah. So that happens. And then you start thinking, I want to get into bigger stuff still. I want to really get into well-being. What drove that?
Well, if you think about public policy, there's got to be some overall concept of what defines a good society. And in the 18th century Enlightenment, they came up with this wonderful idea that a good society is one in which people are fully enjoying their lives, feeling fulfilled, feeling satisfied, and that that is a single overarching good to which everything which happens should be directed. So that applies, for example, to public policy. So the basic idea in political philosophy is that the aim of government should be to promote the happiness or well-being of the people. This was very, very strong right through the English intelligentsia and, of course, the American one. Thomas Jefferson said the sole object of good government is the happiness of the people. That was an extraordinarily strong statement. I can't think of any objections to it, provided you take into account how the happiness is distributed across people. Very, very powerful idea, has had a huge effect on public policy, especially in the English-speaking world ever since. But, of course, it's only recently become possible to apply it fully because we've got the science. I mean, this is also an idea for individuals. This is the foundation of private ethics, that your job on this earth is to produce the most happiness you can in the world around you. So it's a terrifically powerful, encompassing idea about how everybody should behave. And in fact, the justification for any organisation has got to be that it is contributing to the well-being and happiness of people.
It's hard to critique that big thought, but there are objections. One objection is that actually you're kind of doing away with notions of class and power. You're not really questing after solving power imbalances and class imbalances. So there's that challenge. And then another challenge is, come on, this is too soft. It's too soft. I mean, we economists and we social scientists, you know, we want to deal in hard data. And actually, this is kind of, it's too subjective. One person's happiness is not another person's happiness. So you immediately encounter those two problems as you try to get this idea off the ground.
On the first, I mean, that's completely wrong because the power structure affects people's happiness. And what is very interesting, we now have the World Happiness Report, which gives happiness scores based on sample surveys throughout the world to every country. And you see the huge variation in happiness from an average of nearly 8 out of 10 in Scandinavian countries to 3 or less in war-torn or incredibly imbalanced authoritarian countries at the bottom end of the scale. So
Yemen or somewhere is unhappy.
You can study how power matters directly by seeing how it affects happiness.
Okay. I'll park that and come on to the subjective challenge. Because, I mean, there were moments over the last 30 years. And by the way, we should say, we may have become an economist in your 30s. That was 60 years ago. You are 90 on March the 15th. So a kind of a happy birthday from the Academy of Social Sciences. What a career, 60 years of social science. I mean, over the last 30 years, you've been pushing this idea. I mean, there have been moments when it's been kind of mocked because of its subjectivity and its softness. I mean, how have you dealt with that? Personally, have you dealt with that?
Well, the point is that we can measure happiness by asking people questions. That, incidentally, has been done in medicine for a very long time. Medicine would be almost impossible without asking people questions. And I think social science is impossible without asking people questions. If we want to know the ultimate success of policies, it is on how they affect people's direct internal experience of life. And you can only find out about that at the moment by asking them questions. So the best question that we use, which is widely used, is overall, how satisfied are you with your life these days? 0 to 10, 0, not at all satisfied, 10, very satisfied. And the answers to these questions have obvious validity, for example, in their ability to predict all sorts of things about people. So this is one of the best predictors, as good as a medical diagnosis, of how many more years you'll live. It's a good predictor of whether you're going to quit your marriage or your job. And most interestingly, from a policy point of view, it is a better predictor of whether a government will get re-elected than the state of the economy. So politicians, take this seriously, because if you want to get re-elected, you should be trying to maximise people's well-being and not just the state of the economy. The economy contributes to well-being, but lots of other things do. And this measure of well-being is a better predictor of whether you'll get re-elected. So it is a measure with good information content, objective information content, about what ultimately matters, which is our subjective state of mind.
And if I ask you the question, what makes you happy? What would you say to your the question that you ask, you know, the public at large?
Well, I would say family life, my marriage, number one. Number two, feeling I've got some useful work to do that might be of some value to happiness around the place. And third, tennis.
Tennis. Those are your three things that make you happy.
Including games with you, Will.
You are very good at tennis. And as someone who's approaching their 90th birthday, in a way, the proof's in the pudding. I mean, here you are, longevity and as alert as ever. But let's get into the causes then. Everyone's going to come up with those three answers. I mean, and you say that social science provides a lot of data. When, as a social scientist, you start kind of looking into the science of well-being, you know, what are the data points that you are looking for? What's the empirical support? What stops this from being soft into something that's really hard?
Well, Britain is very rich in data. And since 2011, the government has been measuring the well-being of the people as a so-called official national statistic using the annual population survey. But even more useful than that are these longitudinal surveys where you can see how people's happiness fluctuates in response to their experience. So from a combination of these surveys, both in Britain and obviously in other countries, we've got a pretty good handle on what are the most important factors that explain the huge spread of happiness in any community, or what is a similar and related phenomenon, what explains how many people are really miserable in that community. And the order in which these factors come out is always the same. Always first is health, mental as much as physical. Always second is human relationships in the family or private life, at work, especially with the boss, in daily surveys of how people felt during the day. The time they felt less happy than any other time is when they were with their boss. This is a pretty shocking finding. Then third, community. And then last...
And third, community,
Last, after health and human relationships, but very important, of course, is income and debt, especially at the present time with the cost of living crisis. But it just is crucial that we take income seriously, but not more seriously than all the other things that have this huge impact on people's lives. So when you start going to think about policy, you obviously should be paying particular attention to the things which have a big effect, and particularly those that produce a lot of the misery in society. And that means paying a lot of attention to particularly mental health, which has been absolutely shockingly neglected. Paying attention to the development of prevention of mental illness by well-being, proper well-being policies in schools, a proper serious approach to development of life skills in schools, lots of attention to integrating people in society, avoiding a very unequal society with a lot of people with no skill on low pay and low employment rates due to, for example, shocking neglect of vocational education after school, as in Britain. And then, of course, proper social care. So these things, if you look at them in terms of what is the benefit to well-being per pound of public expenditure, rank very, very high when compared with things like road building. And yet there is a constant shortage of money for things which are very, very important to well-being, and more money is being spent on many infrastructure projects which are actually less important to well-being. So the way I like to put it is that if you're thinking about cost-effectiveness, think of social infrastructure as very often as important or more so than physical infrastructure. Don't get hung up on the idea that building things we can touch is more important than touching human hearts.
So many things to pick up there. Earlier on, I referenced, and you said, that you had a hand in building Labour's New Deal when they came into power in 97. But that's not the only area where you've had huge influence. I mean, these ideas, in particular your what you've just said, touching human hearts, and how social infrastructure is as important as physical infrastructure. I mean, you're one of the main drivers of the kind of NHS talking therapies program, the access to cognitive behavioural kind of therapies. It was your pushing that with successive governments that's led to us having this. I mean, you're not just a kind of a man sitting, looking at the data in your office at the London School of Economics. You engage with reality and make things different. But talk about this NHS Talking Therapies programme. Why? Because that's kind of presumably addressing the number one issue of concern to you, people's mental health.
Well, back in the early 2000s, NICE came out with guidelines for the treatment of all conditions, physical and mental.
NICE, just for people who don't know it.
NICE is the National Institute of Clinical Excellence. And these are meant to be applied throughout the National Health Service. But what was striking was that they were mainly being applied for physical illness, and they were mainly not being applied for mental illness. In fact, at that time, under a third of people with diagnosable mental health conditions were in any form of treatment at all. Disgraceful, whereas most people with physical conditions were in treatment. So with the help of a wonderful clinical psychologist, David Clark, we agitated for a program to provide evidence-based psychological therapy for anxiety disorders and depression that we rolled out nationally. And fortunately, it started in 2008. We've had support from every government since. It's grown to now 11,000 therapists working in it, treating 700,000 people each year, of whom 50% recover during the course of treatment because we measure their progress session by session. This is a model that's now being followed in five or six other countries, and I think it is something which will really improve well-being worldwide. But, of course, we need the same sort of thing for young people. Now, we were successful in persuading...
Why do you single out young people particularly?
Well, we need... Adults begin at 18.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Under 18.
You mean under 18, yeah.
There is no comparable service, or wasn't. We persuaded the government to set up what's called mental health support teams in schools in about 2019. But it is going slowly. Its ambition in terms of quality is not as high as the one for adults, which is shocking because most adult problems begin in childhood. And it needs to be spread over much more of the country. It's only covering a third of the country after 6 years of operation. So that's an area where we absolutely need, in the upcoming election, commitments from every party. But another area which really needs covering is addiction. And there are, of course, services to help people dry out, but there are not psychological therapy services for most addicts, although that is the essential need they have if they're not to relapse. So hopefully, again, in the manifestos, we shall see commitment to a service like NHS Talking Therapies targeted at addicts.
When I hear you, I think to myself, there aren't many people in British social science who can claim that they've had that kind of impact. I mean, it's quite a thing that we're listening to. And I'm
Of course, thousands of people have contributed.
Yeah, of course. But I mean,
wonderful support from NHS administrators.
But you ran with the idea. I mean, you were the person who kind of said, "Look, this should be number one policy preoccupation." If you enjoy the We Society podcast, you may also enjoy the Slow Newscast from Tortoise Media. The Slow Newscast is an investigative podcast that aims to tell a fresh, exciting story each week by focusing on the stories that really matter in the UK and around the world. From the war in Ukraine, the downfall of Boris Johnson, to true crime and injustice and real-life mysteries, the Slow Newscast team is devoted to narrative investigations. From a startup newsroom with a different approach to journalism, the Slow Newscast offers a more in-depth take on a single story than the flurry of daily news. There'll be fresh investigations looking at everything from extreme sports to corruption and assassinations. So if you want to slow down, look up the Slow Newscast wherever you get your podcasts. David Cameron had his idea about the big society. Everyone is for societal cohesion and for better communal relationships. I mean, it's like motherhood and apple pie. Again, the question, you know, why has it that community has the same resonance, but it doesn't kind of work for people in the same way in 2024 as it used to? Should the state be intruding into communal relationships?
Well, I think the government always has an effect on the values of the population. All governments have been interested in what values are adopted. Margaret Thatcher changed the values of our society when she said the object of life is wealth creation. And I think we need to have a different concept of the object of life. It should be the happiness of the people. I don't think it's realistic to try and separate the values of people from the values which the government is standing for. The government obviously should respond to popular sentiment, but it also helps to create popular sentiment. And I think that it is really unfortunate that we've got into a situation where it seems to be quite difficult for a politician to talk about people being unselfish. The language is, we are going to help you to achieve your selfish goal, is so dominant now. And I remember I worked in the Department of Education part-time at one stage, and somebody put up a huge, it was 9 stories high, banner, which said, keeping ahead. Keeping ahead was apparently the aim of education, not to develop your capacities to contribute to the community, but keep ahead of somebody else.
You're very much a We Society person, Richard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, look, let's get to the last of these things, income and employment. I mean, you are so passionate about this. You're so passionate about what you regard, I think, as almost the most criminal divide in our country, which is the access to training and apprenticeships of what you call the other half or the bottom 50% compared with the educated middle class, if you like. Just kind of spell that out, because it is, and you know, don't hold back, because I've heard you on this and you are very strong.
Well, if you are of the academic bent, you will know that if you qualify...
As a 16, 17, 18-year-old,
16,
yeah.
17, 18. You know that if you qualify for university, there will be a university place, not necessarily the one you most want, but there will be a place. And that has been a national policy for 60 years. For people who don't want to go to university, there's no such system where if you qualify, you can expect to find a place. Most people would like an apprenticeship if they don't go to university. And yet, at the moment, with the government scheme, there are 3 applicants into the scheme for every place that is filled through the scheme. This is a shocking state of affairs where there is massive unsatisfied demand from people who don't go to university. And I think one of our top national priorities should be to guarantee the offer of an apprenticeship to anybody who's qualified at once one, and I hope we can see that in the election manifestos. But Will, I just want to say something about wellbeing in general. We are making a huge effort to get this seen as the centrepiece for discussion of what sort of society we want, and obviously for the election manifestos. we have launched a world well-being movement which is targeted at, one, governments, that should be the priority for governments, and two, targeted business. Business should pay much more attention to the well-being of its workers and its customers. We also have a movement called Action for Happiness targeted at individuals to help them and support them in living a life which is creating happiness for other people. So think of this as behind the intellectual structure of this, there is also a movement of people putting pressure on people. March the 20th is
International Day of Happiness.
Well said. We're having a huge conference in the Queen Elizabeth Hall and South Bank Centre.
In London, yeah.
In London. And we're going to be sending a petition to all heads of government that at the summit of the future at the UN in September, it should be agreed that the goal of the government is to promote the well-being of their people. And let's put well-being first. That's the slogan.
Let's put well-being first, except sitting in front of me, which the listeners can't see, you have a badge, Action for Happiness.
Ah.
So, you know, in this conversation, happiness and well-being have been interchangeable. Are they interchangeable, or is happiness for individuals and well-being for kind of public policy?
They mean exactly the same thing, as far as I'm concerned. The word happiness is the main word in the English language, and it's got an adjective, happy. So when I wish you a happy new year, as I do now, I don't say, I wish you well-being for the new year. I say, wish you a happy new year. And I say to you, is your child happy at school? Or are you happy in your marriage? I don't say, you know, do you experience well-being? So I think in ordinary parlance, and the thing which moves the heart is the word happiness. On the other hand, the thing which apparently moves the head better is the word well-being. So we use both.
Just to go back to the philosophic roots of this, Richard, utility. There are a lot of people in economics who say, well, you know, that led to kind of the concept of rational economic man. It led to economics going down not a false road, because it's got it's an intellectual edifice that stands, but it tried to pretend that economics was value-free when it's not. And it got in a muddle in which kind of individual choices were social and social became individual, and it wasn't clear what the boundaries were. There were lots of critiques of utilitarianism. Are you still a utilitarian?
I am. And I think that it was the greatest idea of the modern age. It really brought us out of the age when people thought that happiness was for the next world rather than this world. So I think it's profoundly...
That's true.
Profoundly exciting and motivating way of thinking. In 19th century economics, it had a pretty good influence. For example, people felt by introspection that a pound in the hands of a poor person gave more extra happiness than a pound in the hands of a rich person. And that was why they were interested in the redistribution of income. What went wrong was in the beginning of the 20th century, first the psychologists and then the economists took up the position that you couldn't know what anybody was feeling. And all you could look at is how they behaved. And that has been the downfall of economics in the 20th century. And that's led to the view the only thing you can say about somebody, essentially, is what is their purchasing power.
And what are the revealed preferences?
You can't compare happiness between people. All you can do is look at purchasing power, add it up, cross people. That gives you GDP.
So utilitarianism leads to revealed preference, leads to the construction of statistics in aggregate, like gross national product, like GDP, and then add to the mix Mrs. Thatcher saying our preoccupation should be wealth creation, and you have a kind of an edifice which kind of doesn't focus on or kind of leans against a focus on happiness, and you are trying to kind of correct that. Is that a fair description?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not talking now not as a social scientist, but as a kind of campaigner. I think what we absolutely have to do is get away from a society where, because of this strong competitive ethic, we experience so often other people as a threat rather than as a support and as a fellow being in need of support from us. And I think we can build a much more compassionate, other-oriented society. And, you know, if we want a happier society, we've got to have that norm.
This well-being agenda extends from the world of the National Health Service and mental health and talking therapies to the world of relationships, to the world of community, to the world of work, to how we're paid, to how we're trained. It's vast.
It is. Obviously, it encompasses everything. In one sense, it requires you to know everything. But fortunately, we have the social sciences, and each of them has its own expertise, and that is absolutely invaluable. But it has to be seen in the context of how that social science is contributing to our understanding of that source of human happiness. So we have international relations that's contributing, obviously, to the reduction of war and the negative effect of that. We have criminology that tells us how to reduce crime, which affects human well-being and the criminals themselves. We have economics, which tells us mainly about how people acquire income and employment, and so on. So I think this is now a concept that can provide a framework for an integrated social science, seeing each of the separate ones as contributing to the understanding of people's well-being.
So social science to the rescue in the promotion of well-being, both nationally and internationally. Richard Layard, Professor Lord Richard Layard, what's been an extraordinary 45 minutes. Thank you very much. I mean, we've discussed your early career. We've discussed your way into this well-being and happiness agenda because of your preoccupation with unemployment and its impact on people's kind of psychological well-being. And that folded into this last 20 or 30 years. And in front of your 90th birthday, I mean, you are as intellectually alert and as articulate as you were when you were 30. I know of you then. We've known each other for the last four decades, Richard. I find it's very compelling. It's very compelling, and and you've got the old landmark events in the course of the year, and there is progress being made, and let's see how social science responds to your clarion call. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, who can be found at acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. Have any suggestions for guests, feedback for the programme? Email us on wesociety@acss.org.uk. And above all, thank you for listening.